circumstance. That may be true, but none of those clients took me hostage first. You reviewed the information we left in your room. We did not take you hostage. We saved your life. Like he'd said, there was no way for her to know if he was telling the truth or not. The only thing that was clear to her was that trouble awaited her if she attempted to return to her normal life anytime soon. Perhaps you should tell me about this job. We need to talk, Ananka said, standing in Liesl's doorway. Can you come out and join us? When Ananka had returned, she found everyone exactly where she had left them. Rosario and Dylan had wanted to know what happened, but they all needed to be together for this.
What is there to talk about?
Liesl said, without looking over. Our future.
I have no future.
I get it. It's been a rough week for you. Ananka waved her hand back toward the main room. It's been a rough week for all of us, but we have some choices to make, and you need to be a part of that discussion whether you want to be or not, so get off your ass and let's go. Without waiting for a response, Ananka turned and walked over to her own room. As the administrator promised, a file containing the photographs and other information pertaining to the job was waiting for her on her coffee table. When she headed back out, Liesl had joined the others, though she was standing behind the bench, not sitting on it. Ananka climbed in next to Rosario, set the file on the table, and then, as succinctly as possible, laid out the choices the administrator had presented.
I will stay here, Liesl said.
She turned toward her room. Wait, Ananka said. You haven't heard everything.
I have heard enough.
No, you haven't. For a moment, Ananka thought Liesl would walk off anyway, but the woman swiveled back around.
Let me see if I have this right, Dylan said. This job Mr. Administrator is talking about, he's going to pay us for it, double our going rate. And he's going to clear our names so we can go home again.
That's what he said. Rosario frowned. Sounds too good to be true.
Exactly what I told him.
So you don't believe him?
I don't have enough information to determine what I believe.
Rosario considered this for a moment. I am not staying here a minute longer than I have to. I will tell him I want to leave. If he does not let me go, then I will know he is lying.
Or he lets you leave and shoots you in the back on your way out, and we don't know one way or the other, Dylan said. And, you know, you'd be dead.
Better dead than a prisoner.
That seems an awfully permanent solution.
Before Rosario could respond, Ananka said, You might want to hear the details of the job before you go making any decisions. I do not care what the job is, Rosario said. I do not work with kidnappers.
Never? Dylan asked. Are you sure? I know my clients can get their hands pretty dirty sometimes.
Kidnappers who kidnap me, how's that? She asked, glaring at him.
Well, that is a fine point, I'll give you that. But me? I can't deny I'm curious. Double fee sounds pretty good right now.
Ananka opened the file and removed a picture of a passenger van. 2 days ago, a vehicle just like this one left a lodge near Yosemite National Park in California, carrying 6 students and 3 chaperones returning from an educational retreat. They never arrived home. She set another printout on the table. This is a copy of a text sent to the families waiting at the pickup point for their kids. The message read, No press. No police, no feds, nothing. Silence or death. We will contact again. The messages were accompanied by these. She set 6 photographs next to the text message. In each was a different child, bound and gagged, but easily recognizable. 4 were female and 2 were male. The only ones who know about this are the students' families and a few select others that now includes us.
Jesus, Dylan said. And the ransom?
It hasn't come yet.
How much do 6 kids go for these days?
These 3, Ananka touched the appropriate pictures, come from extremely wealthy families. We're talking Silicon Valley kind of money. What about the other 3 students? Rosario asked. The retreat was part of a program to expose kids from different socioeconomic groups to one another, Ananka replied. The other 3 are from working class families. Rosario looked troubled. If the kidnappers need to send a message, these will be the kids sacrificed.
Very likely. What is known about the kidnappers?
Liesl asked.
Nothing. Our job would be to ID them, locate them, and bring the kids home alive. Ananka paused. The question we each need to answer is whether to take the job or choose one of the other options. The room fell silent.
What's your answer?
Rosario finally asked. Ananka had been contemplating that since she left the conference room. The administrator had presented her with enough information for her to believe the story about the missing kids was true, but there was more to this whole saving Ananka and the others and hiring them thing than he was sharing. Still, the kids were in real danger. Her life in the last several years had been full of death. Since she couldn't return to it at the moment, it might be nice to do a little saving. I'm in, she said. Rosario appeared surprised by the answer and fell back into a dark silence.
Hell, it beats hiding out for God knows how long staring at the walls, Dylan said. I'm in too.
These children, Liesl said. You are convinced they are in trouble?
As much as I can be. The thing is, if we find out we've been lied to, we can always walk away. Liesl nodded to herself.
Yes, we can. Then I will help too.
All eyes turned to Rosario.
All right, she said after a moment.
Ananka walked over to the wall near the room's main entrance and pressed the button she found there. Assuming you weren't lying and haven't been listening in, we'll take the job. That's excellent news. Thank you all. From the hallway, they could hear the metal screech of another door opening. There is no time to waste.
20. Undulating floor lights guided them into a locker room containing 5 stalls separated by privacy barriers. 4 of the stalls were stocked with clothes hanging from pegs, footwear on shelves, and pre-packed duffel bags on the floor. The 5th stall was empty. The sizes and styles of the outfits made it obvious whose stall was whose. In Ananka's were a pair of jeans, a white buttoned blouse, and a dark blue duster that went down to the top of her thighs. The duster had been modified with several handy interior pockets. She'd also been provided with a pair of stylish, reddish-brown boots that slipped perfectly under the cuffs of her jeans. After she was dressed, she unzipped her duffel. Inside, she found 2 additional changes of clothes, a phone, a pair of compact yet powerful binoculars, comm gear, lockpicks, and a Heckler & Koch P-30 9mm pistol with suppressor, extra ammo, and $2,000 in cash. The inclusion of the weapons bolstered the idea that the administrator was telling the truth. As she stepped out from her locker area, Dylan said,
You got a gun?
He was peeking around the barrier into the next stall where Liesl was holding her own P-30. He turned back to his bag and began rifling through it.
Where's mine?
Tell me, Dylan, how often have you carried a pistol on a job? Ananka asked.
Well, Okay, never, but...
Looks like your job is driving, she said, nodding at the set of keys he tossed on the ground with the other stuff from his bag. So, same as it was on all those other jobs you didn't have a gun for. He scowled at the keys and then started shoving things back into his bag.
Fine. If I'm driving, then I decide when we stop and when we don't.
Oh, look, Rosario said. I have a gun, too.
When they were ready, the administrator's voice came over the speaker again.
The phones you have been given have been pre-programmed with each other's numbers. There is also one to my office. I would prefer if Ananka serves as the main contact between us. As you have no doubt already assumed, she will act as team leader. Of course, if there is an emergency, you needn't go through her to get to me. Lastly, the 5th member of your team will be joining you at your destination.
5th member? Ananka said.
A hunter.
Given the task they had before them, she thought adding a hunter wasn't a bad idea.
Good luck,
the administrator said.
Find them, please. Get them home.
Lights led the team to a staircase that took them up to a metal door. Stepping outside, they discovered they weren't in a building, but on a container ship. The vessel was moored against a dock of what appeared to be a busy port. Ananka knew the ship had to have been there since before they'd first woken, or they would have felt the movements of the sea. She studied their surroundings in hopes of getting a better idea of where they were. To their left and right was more port. Shoreside, beyond the port facilities, she could see hills dotted with homes. Given that the descending sun was behind them, hidden by the ship, the hills were to the east. She looked up at the ship's superstructure behind them and spotted walkways around several of the upper levels, but no way to reach them. She wondered if the administrator was up there somewhere. Someone who worked for him definitely had to be on the ship. Either that, or they'd been fed by ghosts.
"There's a gangway over here," Dylan called from the other end of the walkway.
They joined him and headed down to the pier.
"Holy crap! I hope that's our ride,"
he said, staring at a dark blue Mustang parked next to a pier-side building with several other vehicles. He pulled out the keys and pressed the unlock button on the fob, but the responding flashing lights came from a passenger van two vehicles away.
"Son of a mother, are you kidding me?"
Stepping onto the pier, Ananka looked back at the ship and noted the name Charis Ivanus painted on the bow.
"California plates," Dylan said as they neared the van.
The cars parked around it also had California license plates. This wasn't particularly surprising, given that the kids had been kidnapped within the state. As they climbed into the van, Dylan tossed an envelope that had been on the driver's seat to Ananka.
"This must be for you, boss."
Inside, she found false IDs for each of them and handed them out. There were also four printouts for room reservations at Hardwick Inn, located in Groveland, California, under their new assumed names. Groveland, Ananka knew from the map that had been in her file, was near Yosemite. As they left the port, they learned that the Charis Ivanus was docked at the port of Oakland, across the bay from San Francisco, leaving them a 3-hour drive to the mountains where the kids were last seen. Once Dylan got them onto the interstate headed east, Ananka began sifting through the contents of the file to commit the details to memory.
"I would like to look at those too," Rosario said.
"And me also," Liesl chimed in.
While the women studied, Dylan kept up a continuous monologue of jokes and stories that none of them paid attention to. Ananka had become so used to tuning him out that she was caught off guard when he tapped her on the shoulder and said,
"What do you think?"
"About what?"
"About taking a toilet break, maybe getting something to eat. Am I just talking to myself here?"
"You don't want me to answer that." They stopped at a gas station megaplex that boasted two fast food places, a mini market, and showers that could be rented by the minute. While the others used the facilities, Ananka went into the mini market and purchased a burner phone and several SIM cards. Outside, she found a deserted area near the dumpsters and activated the cell.
"Moshi Moshi," Shinji said. "Nakamura Restaurant, can you hold for a—"
"It's me," she said.
Not a sound for two whole seconds, then,
"Would you like to hear our specials?"
This was the first part of the code to be used in situations when Shinji felt it necessary to determine whether Ananka was speaking freely or in trouble. If the latter, there were several different responses she could make, each signaling him to do something different. For instance, if she said, "Yes, please," he would determine her location and arrange for her to be extracted ASAP. If the former, the response was more direct.
"Cut the crap," she said. "Oh, thank God. Where the hell have you been? Are you all right? What happened? I thought you were either dead or Perkins got you."
"I'm fine, and he didn't. I need to know what's going on out there."
"I'm fine, and he didn't? That's all I get?"
"We can catch up later. Update now, please."
"Okay, okay. Well, word on the net is that you're supposed to be detained, but I guess that's not surprising, huh?"
"No, it's not. Have I received any messages?"
"Only one. Quinn. He said if you needed anything, let him know."
Given her current situation, most people would have distanced themselves from her. In fact, most had. Not Jonathan Quinn. She'd helped him out the previous summer, and he was not one to forget those he owed, no matter what trouble they might be in. His message was even more meaningful because the last she'd heard, he was dealing with a personal tragedy of some sort. "Tell him I appreciate the offer and that I'm okay."
"Are you okay?"
"At the moment. Look, I need you to find out everything about a cargo ship called the Charis Ivanus." She spelled it out for him.
"Okay. Do I need to know context?"
"Not right now. I'm also going to text you some names. Be very discreet."
SOP.
Standard operating procedure.
"Until I tell you otherwise, only text me back if I text you first. And do not call this number until I give you the go-ahead." "Got it."
Good. She hung up.
Here we go, Miss Handler.
The woman behind the desk handed Ananka a key.
You are in room 15.
She passed another to Rosario.
And Miss Rivera, yours is room 14. Now let's see. Miss Cooper, for you, room 7.
She handed a key to Liesl, then picked up another and gave it to Dylan.
And Mr. Drake, room 5. Do you happen to know when your roommate will be here?
My roommate?
Yes.
She looked back at the screen of her ancient computer.
Mr. Brambles. His reservation was tied to yours.
We're not sure of his schedule, Ananka said before Dylan could open his mouth. If we hear from him, we'll let you know. They picked up their bags and headed for the stairs. As soon as they were out of earshot of the reception desk, Dylan said,
Roommate?
The hunter, I assume, Ananka said. Dylan grimaced.
Why can't the hunter and I have our own rooms, and two of you share?
If you would like, I am sure we can take a vote,
Rosario said.
But you...
He stewed for a moment.
That's not fair.
Ananka patted him on the back. Now you know what it's like to be a woman. Though a few hours of sleep was what they really needed, Ananka wanted to get a look at the area where the van had disappeared. So they dropped their things in their rooms and were soon back on the road, heading farther east into the mountains. Security footage had shown the kids' van leaving the Conifer Lodge, where the retreat had been held, at 8:42 a.m. on the day they vanished. The vehicle should have next appeared on cameras outside the Groveland Fire Station, but it never did. So whatever happened had occurred somewhere in between. While Dylan drove, the women scanned both sides of the road. Except for gaps here and there where a house or other type of building had been constructed, the route was lined by trees. There were plenty of places where the van could have gone, but none was any better than the rest.
An army could search through the area for a year and never find them,
Dylan said as the Conifer Lodge came into view.
Someone checked satellites, I assume?
Rosario said. So I was told, Ananka replied.
Every satellite?
That I don't know.
I am sure some were missed. When we get back, I'll look into it.
Ananka liked Rosario's confidence, but didn't know how good the woman was. Even if she was the best hacker in the world, there would be only so much she could do on the laptop that had been in her duffel bag. It'll go faster if you had help.
I do not mean to offend you, but you would just get in my way.
I wasn't talking about me, Ananka said. I have a friend who won't get in your way. I'll put you in touch with him.
A friend? Are we involving others now?
He works for me. Any job I'm on, he's on.
I can do it myself. I don't need anyone.
Ananka's phone buzzed with a text. Give him a try, she said to Rosario as she pulled out her cell. You might be surprised. The message was from the administrator. Your hunter has arrived.
Good news, Dylan, Ananka announced. Looks like your roommate's here.
It was dark by the time they returned to the Hardwick Inn. As they entered the lobby, the woman behind the desk waved and said,
Mr. Drake, you just missed Mr. Brambles. I pointed him toward Maisie's Diner down the street not 5 minutes ago.
Ananka thanked the clerk, and she and the team headed back outside. They found Maisie's Diner a few blocks down. A buzz of voices and clinking utensils and plates greeted them. Ananka stopped near a sign that read, Seat Yourself, and scanned the room. All the booths and tables were occupied by couples and families. The only solo men she saw were seated at the counter and had the look of locals. Of course, the best hunters knew how to blend in. She was in the process of assessing them one by one when a voice boomed across the dining room.
Kitty cat!
Until that moment, she had not been aware her blood could turn cold so fast. Eyes narrowing to slits, she turned toward the speaker. Standing outside the hallway to the bathrooms, smiling his million-dollar smile, was her misogynistic, narcissistic, supposed to still be in prison, ex-boyfriend. Ricky Orbitz. A giant grin on his face, he began walking toward her.
Did you miss me, kitten?
Trying to ignore the shiver of disgust running up her spine, Ananka whispered to the others, Get something to eat. And then, with a flick of a finger, motioned for Orbitz to follow her outside. A slight breeze blew past the front of the restaurant as she stepped into the night and walked to the corner of the building. There she waited until Ricky appeared.
Before he could say a word, she headed toward the back of the restaurant, stopping near a pile of pallets and empty pickle barrels. A few seconds later, Mr. Wonderful arrived, still wearing his ear-to-ear smile.
Baby, ain't this great? I didn't think I'd get to see you for years. How about a little kiss?
He threw his arms out and stepped toward her, but as soon as he was in range, she shoved him in the chest and sent him sprawling into the side of the building.
Kitty cat, what did I do to deserve that?
Seriously, Ricky? Seriously? She grabbed his shirt and jammed him back against the wall.
Number one, I told you to never call me that again. Number two, you're supposed to be in prison.
He snickered.
I know. Isn't it awesome?
How did you get out? She said, teeth clenched.
Apparently, I'm in demand.
She bounced him off the wall.
Tell me how you got out. All right, all right. Save the physical stuff for later, baby.
Her eyes flared, but before she could do anything else, he raised his hands in surrender.
Just a joke, just a joke.
He smiled again and leaned forward like he was about to impart top-secret information.
This woman shows up at Crestridge, you know, my home away from home, and says she can spring me if I'd do a job for her people. Like I'd pass up that opportunity, right?
He straightened back up, looking playfully suspicious.
You know this already, though, don't you? Miss Marsh is one of your friends, isn't she? Of course she is. Why else would I be here?
I would put you in solitary for the rest of your life before I would ever lift a finger to get you out. He chuckled.
Now you're just being coy. Damn, woman, I knew you still loved me, but I didn't think it was this much.
He was dead wrong, though she'd come very close to falling in love before she'd regained her senses that night she found him playing naked Twister with a couple of 20-something Twister professionals. In a soft yet deadly tone, she said, "Jeopardize the mission again, and I'll have our client pull you off the team. Is that clear?"
Hold on now.
She stared at him, an eyebrow raised.
Fine, he said. I'll be good.
He cocked his head.
Aren't you gonna answer that?
What? He nodded at the vibrating pocket of her duster. She jammed her hand inside and pulled out her phone. The caller ID read Administrator. With a final shove to Ricky's chest, she walked away and pressed accept.
Good evening, Ananka, the administrator said. Have you connected with Mr. Orbitz yet? You son of a bitch, what the hell is he doing here? You need a hunter. My understanding is he's one of the best.
His understanding was correct, but she had no intention of confirming that. And you just happened to have a get-out-of-jail-free card lying around you used to set him loose?
In a manner of speaking.
I want him out of here.
All right.
Name me a hunter who can do a better job than Mr. Orbitz and is available, and I'll get him. The administrator said.
Alan Kubik.
Working in Kazakhstan, I believe.
Noriko Motohashi.
We've attempted to contact her, but have had no replies.
Russell Parker.
Retired and not answering calls. She dug for another name.
Donald Wilkinson.
Also retired, I'm afraid. Ananka stared at the ground, her mind scrambling. But the truth was, she'd just named four of the five top hunters in the world. Coming in at number three, Ricky rounded off that list.
We can do this without a hunter, she said.
If you had more time, perhaps. My job, however, is to provide you with the best tools I can. Mr. Orbitz is an asset you can't afford to turn away. As much as she hated to admit it, the administrator was right.
Damn it. Fine, he can stay. But I can't guarantee I won't kill him at some point.
Thank you. I'm sure he'll deserve it if that becomes necessary. Ananka then caught him up on what little they'd been able to do so far. After she hung up, she turned back to Ricky.
Is it official?
He asked.
Are we working together again?
So it would seem. The Ricky grin returned as he lifted his arms.
Bring it in here, baby.
She turned and walked away. 21. 6 minutes later, Office of the Administrator. A single screen on the administrator's wall flickered to life with the image of Committee Member Monday.
Orbitz has joined the field team, the administrator reported.
And she accepted him?
She wasn't happy about it, but she understands the need.
And the mission?
They've only been in the area for a couple hours, so nothing yet.
What are they?
Apologies, sir, the administrator said as the light for the emergency line on his phone began blinking. May I put you on hold for one moment?
When Monday nodded, the administrator muted the video link and picked up his phone.
The call lasted just over 2 minutes. When it was completed, he reactivated the video chat. That was one of the people I have with the families, he said. A ransom demand has been received. 10 million per child.
Interesting. And the deadline?
72 hours from... He checked the time on his computer. 13 minutes ago. The ransom note came by an email and was sent only to the three families with the means to pay it. So far, nothing has been received by the other three families.
$30 million. That's quite a...
No, sir. 60. They want 10 for each of the 6 children, or none will be returned.
Is that so? Monday said. Keep me informed.
Of course.
22. Sierra Nevada Mountains, California.
As she was getting ready to go to bed, Ananka received the administrator's message about the ransom demand and the deadline. She called the others and switched their rendezvous time from 4 a.m. to 3 a.m. She would have liked to move it up even earlier, but they had to get some rest. With under 3 days until time ran out for the hostages, who knew when they'd get the opportunity to rest again? But sleep came in dribs and drabs, her mind still agitated by Ricky's presence. That he had such an effect on her was her own damn fault. She should have never become involved with him in the first place. All the warning signs had been there, on giant, horizon-filling billboards that she'd chosen to ignore. She'd been seduced due to her admiration of his skills and a bad boy phase that was now, thanks to Ricky, behind her. Could she work with him? Yes. They'd been on the same job the previous summer, the same one she'd helped Quinn on. Technically, they'd been on conflicting sides, but she had avoided killing him then, so she figured she could probably keep from sticking a knife in him now. It would have been nice, though, if the administrator had informed her ahead of time that Ricky was the hunter. She'd almost lost her cool in front of the others, and she couldn't have that if she was running things. Before her alarm rang at 2:30, she was up and on the phone with Shinji. He gave her the rundown on what he'd found out about her team members, all of which confirmed what Ananka already knew or sensed about them. He then moved on to the Karis Ivanis.
The registration is legit, but I can't find anything but a P.O. box address in Panama for the company who owns it, so it's gotta be a cover for something. I can keep digging if you want.
I do, but I'm going to need you to back burner it for a while. I'm going to connect you with Rosario, and I want you to help her out. She might be a little resistant at first, so give her some of your charm.
I have charm?
Fake it. Ananka arrived at the van a minute before Rosario and Liesl got there. They shared nods, but no one said anything. The peaceful silence changed the moment Ricky and Dylan walked out. The two men were in the middle of a one-sided conversation, Ricky talking, Dylan sleepily listening and nodding. As they neared, Ricky let out a loud belly laugh as if he'd just said the funniest thing ever.
Volume, Ananka whispered harshly.
Sorry, Ricky said. I was just telling Dylan here what Rocket Man did on that.
Ricky, shut up.
You got it. Sorry, kitten.
She glared at him.
I mean, sorry, boss.
He flashed a toothy smile. She took a deep centering breath and then looked at Rosario. I want you to stay here and work on those satellite images and see whatever else you can dig up. I'll send you Shinji's number, the guy I was talking about. He knows you'll be calling him.
Shinji? Ricky bellowed. Hey, I like that guy. Tell him,
Ricky, Ananka growled.
Hi, from me,
he finished in a faux whisper. Ananka pulled out her phone and texted Shinji's contact information to Rosario.
If you really can't work with him, let me know, she said as Rosario's phone buzzed.
Rosario looked skeptical but said nothing. Ananka turned to Ricky.
You've been briefed?
About the kids? Yep.
And can I assume you have a vehicle, or did someone drop you off?
Nobody drops Ricky off.
He pointed across the lot at a dark blue Chevy Silverado crew cab.
They gave you a truck? Dylan said. No, that's just not fair.
Her gaze still on Ricky, Ananka said, Go hunt. Any lead you find, you let me know right away. He bowed deeply.
As you wish, m'lady.
He twirled around and headed toward the truck. Liesl and Dylan, Ananka said, let's do some of our own hunting. With the trail almost 3 days cold, Ananka decided to focus their initial efforts on buildings in the disappearance zone where the kids might have been taken. Even if they'd been kept someplace only temporarily, there might be clues to where they'd gone next. But at house after house, they found nothing. After they'd been at it for almost 2 hours, they pulled into the parking lot of an abandoned motel.
Doesn't look like anyone's been here in ages, Dylan said as he parked.
It was the kind of place where guests stayed in individual cabins. It had undoubtedly been nice once, but now was beyond repair. The central building where the front desk would have been lay in the middle of the complex next to the lot. Its windows had been knocked out years ago, and the roof sagged between rafters like a hammock. As Ananka opened her door, she said to Dylan, Kill the engine. It'll go faster if we're all looking around this time.
Wait, 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 he said with a smile and a shake of his head. I'm the driver, remember? Not the gun-toting haunted house investigator. That's your job.
And I'm the boss, Ananka said, smiling back. Now get out. As Ananka led Dylan and Liesl up to the main building, the van beeped, signaling its locks had been engaged. She shot a look at Dylan.
I don't know about you, he said, but I'd like it if no one was waiting for us inside when we come back.
Like who?
It doesn't matter who. Are you telling me this place doesn't give you the creeps?
Ananka snorted and stepped across the threshold. A warped reception counter stretched across the room toward the back, but whatever else had been in there was gone. They searched the rest of the building, but found nothing of interest. When they exited, Dylan headed toward the van.
Where do you think you're going? Ananka said. There's more.
Not the cabins,
he said, not hiding his dread.
Yes, the cabins.
The first two cabins were as unhelpful as the main building. When Ananka reached the third, however, she paused outside the entrance. The layer of dust on the threshold was nowhere near as thick as she'd seen elsewhere. Shining her flashlight inside, she saw dozens of recent footprints and three large rectangular areas where there was also little dust. The spots were side by side and the right size and shape for sleeping bags. As interesting as the discovery was, the recent occupants could have been anyone, hikers, campers, someone wanting to avoid paying for a hotel room. And though she knew the marks had been made in the last week, no one had done her the courtesy of writing the actual date in the dust.
Ananka, Liesl called from outside. Come look.
Ananka found Liesl along the side of the third cabin, pointing her flashlight at the ground. Smack dab in the center of the halo was a tire track.
A street bike, Dylan said, looking over their shoulders. You can tell from the tread pattern.
There are two more.
Liesl swung the beam and revealed the additional marks. Dylan examined them for a moment.
Street bikes again. Different tire brands, though. The tracks are pretty wide, so I'd say the bikes are substantial. Maybe touring bikes, something like that.
Is this it, or did you find others? Ananka asked.
No others, Liesl said.
Three sets of tracks, three imprints of sleeping bags inside. Without moving, Ananka followed the tracks with her light back to the area in front of the cabins, where they turned and disappeared from sight. Still no way to know if they had anything to do with the missing kids. They searched around cabin three a bit more, but discovered nothing else useful. While Liesl and Dylan checked the remaining cabins, Ananka called Rosario.
Find anything? She asked. It turns out that it was cloudy on the day of the kidnapping, so all visual spectrum satellite images are useless. There is, though, an NSA satellite in the vicinity that photographs in alternate spectrums. Unfortunately, it is not directly overhead, so the images we are interested in are at an angle. This means the mountains block a lot of the view, but there are parts of the road we can see. Shinji is going through it frame by frame now.
So he's working out for you?
He is useful so far.
Ananka grinned to herself. I have something else for you to check out while you're looking at images. She told Rosario about the motorcycles. Just want to rule out the possibility they had anything to do with this.
We do not need the satellites for that. Security camera footage would be faster. Let me see what I can hack into. It should be easy enough to establish if the motorcycles were in the area or not.
Rosario had expected Shinji to be another wannabe hacker who could do a few tricks but was otherwise worthless. As a test, she'd tasked him with breaking into the NSA satellite database, figuring it would tie him up for hours. She then set about hacking into it herself. She was still working on the secondary firewall when Shinji called back and told her he was in. Her response was at first disbelief, and then surprise after he provided her a pathway into the satellite's data. Either he'd been lucky, or he was better than she was, considerably. After she finished talking to Ananka, she initiated a new video chat with Shinji.
Anything? She asked.
I found a clear view of the road about 5 miles west of the Conifer Lodge. The van never showed up. I even went an hour beyond when I should have seen it. Nothing.
Show me the location.
She heard Shinji clicking a few keys before a map appeared on her screen, with a marker hovering over the spot he'd described.
You are sure you did not miss the van? She asked.
You can look at the data yourself if you want, but you're not going to find anything.
He was probably right, but she didn't know him well enough to take him at his word.
Send it to me.
Okay.
She could hear him typing for several seconds. A second after he stopped, a message box appeared on her screen, asking if she wanted to accept a file transfer.
I converted it to a single movie, he said. You can speed it up, slow it down, whatever you want.
Thank you.
She initiated the download, then said,
We have something new to look into.
What is it?
She passed on Ananka's request.
We'll take 15 minutes to find as many of the security cameras as we can. After that, we divide them between us and search footage in a 24-hour window before and after the van left the lodge. If we do not see any motorcycles that fit the description, or we do but they leave the area before the van disappeared, then we do not worry about them.
That's still a lot of footage. I could automate the process. Set one of my computers to check all the cameras.
You have an image recognition program that will do this?
I do.
How fast?
He paused.
20 minutes to get it running, then 5 minutes per camera processing.
Accuracy?
About 90%.
That wasn't perfect, but a 10% error rate seemed a fair enough exchange for not wasting time they could spend on something else.
Let's do it.
They found 9 cameras in their target area, 7 of which stored footage far enough back to be useful. While Shinji dealt with the footage, Rosario reviewed the satellite info he'd sent and confirmed the van had not driven past. She texted this information to Ananka and turned her attention to looking into the backgrounds of the missing kids and their chaperones. The 3 rich kids all went to private schools and were stars in one way or another, debate, student government, and track. The lower-income kids went to public schools, where it would be generous to say extracurricular programs were limited. What they shared was their level of intelligence. All were part of gifted programs and had IQs above 140. This apparently had gained each of them membership in an organization called Point Five, a kind of Nouveau Mensa Club which sponsored the retreat. A soft bong signaled Shinji wanted to reconnect. She accepted the request and then returned her attention to the article about Point Five.
I found them, Shinji said.
Rosario blinked and looked at the chat box.
The motorcycles?
Uh-huh.
In our time frame?
I have them on 3 different cameras in Groveland, driving toward the abandoned motel late on the afternoon before the kidnapping.
Faces?
He shook his head.
All wearing helmets.
License numbers, then?
The only camera with a decent angle didn't have the resolution to pick them out.
Did you see when they left?
They didn't leave.
They must have stayed longer than the search window. Expand the parameters and find—
Already expanded. Had my analyzer concentrate on footage from the camera with the best shot of the road, and ran through everything recorded up to just a few minutes ago. The motorcycles never went back west.
You're sure it didn't miss them?
Positive. They either dumped the bike somewhere and left in another vehicle, or they drove out a different way.
How many other ways out are there?
Based on their last known location, 4. But there are minor roads, partly dirt, partly paved, and lots of twists and turns. Difficult for anyone who doesn't know the area to navigate. Plus, not great on those kinds of bikes. The only other way would be to drive through Yosemite and exit the east side to Highway 395. I have my computer searching for cameras on that route right now.
Okay, let me know.
As she reached to disconnect, she paused.
Shinji?
Yeah?
Good work.
He nodded and the chat window shut off. When he called back 45 minutes later, his answer was unchanged. The motorcycles had driven into the area the day before the kidnapping, but had never driven out. It still wasn't proof the riders had anything to do with the kid's disappearance, but it was troubling. Rosario reached for her phone. As soon as she hung up, Ananka shared Rosario's news about the motorcycles with Liesl and Dylan.
So, more missing people? Dylan asked.
Or they were involved and left their bikes behind, Ananka said. Or maybe hauled them out in a truck.
Or they are still camping in the mountains, Liesl said.
Or that, too. Ananka stared out the front window of the van, across the parking lot at the Conifer Lodge. The sun had risen about 30 minutes before, but it was still too early to go noising around inside.
Uh-oh, Dylan said.
Ananka glanced over and saw that he was staring at a sheriff's car heading their way.
You don't think they're coming for us, do you?
He asked. Start the engine, Ananka said, her gaze glued to the approaching car. Dylan turned the ignition.
We can't outrun him in this.
You are a driver, Liesl said. You will outdrive him.
Right. I'll try to remember that.
He grabbed a transmission, ready to drop it into drive.
Wait, Ananka said.
The sheriff's car had slowed. When it was still half the lot away, it swung in a wide U-turn and pulled to a stop at the curb. Two deputies climbed out and went inside the lodge. Dylan shut the engine off.
Maybe they're just getting something to eat?
Let's hope so, but we don't go in until they leave. The wait wasn't long. 5 minutes after the deputies entered the lodge, they came back out.
Is that your friend? Liesl asked.
Ananka groaned. Walking between the deputies, hands cuffed behind his back, was Ricky Orbitz. 23. Just after 3 a.m. again. Ricky knew Ananka was only playing it up for her crew. No way could she still be mad at him. Their breakup had been at least 3 years ago and had happened because of a simple misunderstanding. He hadn't actually liked either of the girls he was with when Ananka found him. Well, liked, sure. That redhead, whatever her name was, had been particularly talented, but not liked. He'd just been blowing off some steam. What was wrong with that? Of course, there'd also been that unfortunate run-in the previous summer that landed him in prison, but he should have been the one mad about that, not her. No, she was just playing her cards tight to the vest, not wanting to show the others she had a favorite right off the bat. He had no doubt that as soon as they found some time to be alone, she'd be all over him.
Oh, Ricky, it's so good to see you. Oh, Ricky, I've missed you so much. Oh, Ricky, take me here.
Admittedly, those probably weren't the exact words she'd use, but something similar. He allowed himself to muse about his once and future girlfriend for another few seconds before turning his attention to the job at hand. He had a vested interest in its success, after all.
Just so we're clear, Mr. Orbitz, Miss Marsh had said after filling him in on the job during their private flight to California, your continued freedom is contingent on the children being found alive.
A few lost kids? No problem.
Might have been what he'd said, but what he'd been thinking was, he would never allow himself to be taken back to prison, no matter the outcome of the mission. Ms. Marsh turned out to be some kind of mind reader.
And in case you decide not to honor our deal?
She motioned to someone sitting at the back of the jet. Up walked the bruiser who'd been with her at the prison, and his clone who'd been waiting for them on the plane. The former was carrying a leather pouch that he set on the table in front of Ms. Marsh. He opened it so that it lay flat. Strapped to one side was an odd-looking gun,
Sort of Buck Rogers meets vaccination gun. The man inserted a tube from the other half of the pouch into the barrel. At the same time, his partner moved next to Ricky.
Take off your shirt.
Ricky snorted.
Right, I don't think so.
Do it, Ms. Marsh said, or we'll return to Crest Ridge and put you back in your old cell.
Hey, just joking. No problem. I'll take it off.
He removed the polo shirt she had given him before they left the prison and flexed his toned arms, showing off his pecs. Prison had been useful in that respect.
Not bad, huh? He said to Miss Marsh. Go ahead. You can touch.
A small circle of cold metal pressed against his right side below his pectoral muscle, and bam, something shot painfully under his skin.
Hey! He yelled, jerking away. What the hell?
He looked down at his torso and saw a red circle where the gun had shot him, surprisingly tiny for the amount of pain that had come with it. The circle of cold was on him again, pressing below his shoulder blade. Bam! Twisting sideways, he tried to knock the guy's arm away, but his tormentor had already moved out of the way.
Seriously, what the hell?
The big man jabbed the gun into Ricky's bicep and pulled the trigger.
Ow! I swear to God, if you do that again...
Pants off,
the second man ordered.
Are you kidding? Not a chance.
Pants off.
You can go ahead and turn this plane around because they are staying on.
Very well, Miss Marsh said. She rose and moved into the aisle. I'll inform our pilot.
Ricky let her get almost to the cockpit door before he closed his eyes and said, Wait. She turned back, an eyebrow raised.
Okay, he said.
She didn't move. He unbuckled his belt and dropped his pants to the floor.
Thank you, she said, heading back to her seat.
Underwear, too,
the talking half of Tweedledee and Tweedledum said.
Hold on. Where are you thinking of shooting me?
Underwear.
Again, he had but one choice. Before he could pull them down, the man added,
Face the window.
Ricky turned begrudgingly and lowered his Fruit of the Looms.
Bend over.
I'm flattered and all, but not everyone who goes to prison is into this kind of thing.
Bend over.
This time, the words were accompanied by a shove to Ricky's back. Reluctantly, Ricky leaned toward the window. In rapid succession, he was shot twice in the butt, first in the right cheek and then the left.
You can get dressed now,
the talker said. Once clothed again, Ricky sat, gingerly, back in his chair and glared at Miss Marsh.
What the hell was that all about?
Our insurance, in case you decide to disappear. Consider yourself lowjacked.
Tracking bugs?
He figured it was something like that.
As I said, insurance.
But why five, for God's sake?
You could deal with the pain of digging one out. Five? Less likely. But even if you were inclined to try, you might have noticed some of them are really hard to reach. We'd find you long before you removed them.
As much as he wished otherwise, she was right. He had to see this thing through. Good thing he was the best hunter in the business. If he knew himself, and he did, he'd find the kids and have them home to Mom and Dad within 24 hours. First, though, he needed to pick up the trail. He went to the spots all trails had in common, the starting point. The Conifer Lodge was located not too far west of Yosemite National Park, in a shallow vale between tree-covered ridges on the north side of the highway. The lodge itself had 70 guest rooms, a popular restaurant on the ground floor, a gift shop, and an area for activities such as horseback riding and archery. Ricky parked the Silverado in the lot among a group of SUVs and then spent the next 15 minutes watching the front of the lodge. The security camera above the main door was easy to spot. From its position, he knew it wasn't the same one that had recorded the footage Miss Marsh had shown him of the van leaving the lodge. The camera had to be located down at the other end of the parking area. He didn't see any others, and if there was a guard who patrolled the facility, he sure didn't get around to the front very often, because Ricky hadn't seen him either. Ricky slipped out of his car and walked a wide arc around the archery range so that he could approach the lodge from behind. There were several outbuildings scattered across the back of the property. He used them to move within 40 feet of the lodge's rear entrance without ever exposing himself. From there, he studied the building. Stone steps led up to a partially covered deck and several sets of glass double doors to the main lodge. Ricky scanned the structure with his binoculars for more security cameras, but saw none. He sauntered over to the building and let himself in. Turned out, the night clerk was the only person awake on the entire first floor. The kid, who couldn't have been more than 20, sat behind the front desk watching a video on a computer, headphones on. Ricky had asked Ms. Marsh a lot of questions after he was chipped and she finished her brief. Among his inquiries had been one about the layout of the lodge. He could tell she'd been impressed with that, but that was to be expected. Ricky was impressive. He didn't know how not to be. She had floor plans sent to her while they were still in the air, and he'd been able to study them as the plane approached the airport outside Sacramento. So he'd likely find what he was looking for in one of the private offices on the other side of the door, behind the front desk. Luckily, there was a second way to get there that didn't involve having to ask the night clerk to get out of Ricky's way. Getting to that back door, however, did mean he needed to cross the lobby. After easing around the corner in a crouch, he crept over to one of the couches that faced a giant fireplace. The night clerk didn't even flinch. Ricky slunked along the sofa as far as he could go, and then paused. Now came the hard part. Between him and the hallway to the back door was 30 feet of floor that was in full view of the clerk. That was a whole lot more exposure than Ricky liked. The front desk was closer, under 20 feet. If he could get there, he could use it as a shield while he moved over to the hallway. Or he could knock the kid out.
Kidding, just kidding, he thought.
Eyes on the clerk, he took a breath and snuck across the stone floor to the safety of the counter. No movement or sound from the other side. Ricky smiled.
Damn, I'm good.
1 second later, his shoe caught on a rough spot of stone, causing a squeak. He froze. From the other side of the counter came the creak of a chair, followed by the tinny, muted sound of music. The clerk had removed his headphones.
Everything's fine. Go back to your stupid video. Nothing to see here.
Another chair creaked, longer this time. Then a step. Crap. Ricky could feel the clerk standing no more than 2 feet away, the counter the only thing separating them. If the kid leaned forward far enough, he would see the top of Ricky's head.
Buddy, just sit down.
A tense silence.
Seriously, man, I said I was joking about knocking you out. Don't make me do it.
A floorboard groaned. Not a step, more the shifting of weight. The sound of a door opening was totally unexpected. Even odder, it wasn't a regular door. The sound was more distinctive, like one for a refrigerator? A moment later, it closed again, and then the hiss of an opening soda can filled the air. This was followed by the chair creaking again, and the disappearance of the tinny headphone music. After giving it an extra 20 seconds to make sure the clerk had indeed retaken his seat, Ricky continued down the counter and entered the hall. The door to the management section was locked, but it was one of those off-the-shelf, in-the-doorknob kind of keyholes and yielded to his picks in seconds. A new hallway, smaller, with 4 office doors on the right and the door to the front desk area on the left. Ricky made a quick survey of all the offices. The first two each had a couple of desks and a few filing cabinets crammed inside. The 3rd and 4th offices had only 1 desk each. On the walls in the 3rd were posters touting worker safety and insurance benefits and employees' rights. The HR office, he guessed. The 4th was clearly the lodge manager's. Along with a nicer desk and matching filing cabinets was a large framed photograph of the lodge from at least 50 years earlier. Also hanging on a wall was a diploma revealing the manager's name as Scott Larson and that he had a degree in hospitality management from Washington State University. Ricky took a seat at the man's desk and fired up the computer. As was all the rage, the screen was password protected. Ricky searched the desk area and found a piece of paper with the man's login taped to the back of a family picture on Larson's credenza. It took Ricky a little over a minute to find the registration information for the missing kids. They had used a total of 6 rooms, The three chaperones had their own rooms while the kids paired off. Ricky brought up a list of other guests who'd stayed there at the same time. Since the summer season had yet to begin, there had been only 37 others. Of those, 28 remained at the lodge for at least an additional 2 days after the kids, while the other 9 left the same day. The 9 consisted of 2 families, one of 4 and one of 3, who had both been at the lodge at least a week before the kids' arrival, and 2 solo male travelers who had checked in the day before the kids got there. Ricky took a picture of the list. Normally, his next move would have been to call one of his contacts and have the person do background checks on the guests. But even if Miss Marsh hadn't explicitly warned him not to communicate with anyone from his old life, he had a feeling most of his contacts wouldn't have picked up the phone. He was supposed to be in prison for screwing up a job, after all. No one would want anything to do with him. That meant he'd have to hand the names over to Ananka. That bummed him out. Even if she was apparently in charge of their little gang, he would rather present her with fully researched information, or even better, with the kids themselves. How she'd love him for that. C'est la vie. He brought up the records for the kids again. According to the database, they and their chaperones checked out at 8:27 a.m. Getting into the security camera footage required an additional password. Ricky typed in the manager's screen password and let out a quiet, "Ha!" as access to the security camera system was granted. It was amazing how many people didn't take the time to create different passwords, but he wasn't complaining. It sure made his job easier. Whoever had set up the camera footage database needed a lesson in organization. The thing was a mess. Ricky figured it out, though, and tracked down the footage for the morning the kids had left. First, he verified that the clip Miss Marsh had shown him had indeed been recorded on the camera at the west end of the parking lot at the time she had told him. Next, he switched to footage from the camera directly above the lodge entrance and started watching at the 8:25 a.m. mark. The kids began trickling out by 8:28. They seemed bored, or maybe they were still tired. Ricky was willing to admit he wasn't exactly an expert when it came to anyone under 20. By 8:33, all 6 kids and 2 of the chaperones were standing near the curb with their bags. A white passenger van pulled up at 8:35, driven by the 3rd chaperone. Luggage was loaded into the rear and everyone climbed in. The van departed at 8:41. Ricky reached to stop the playback, but paused his finger above the spacebar as a trio of motorcycles passed into frame, heading in the same direction the van had gone. It might have been a coincidence, but in a hunt, one could not afford to ignore anything. He tried enlarging the image of the bikers, but the picture became fuzzy pixels. He zoomed the image back out and noted what he could. Big bikes with cargo bins straddling the rear wheels. The kind of bike you might want on a camping trip, and probably a common sight in places like Yosemite. The bikers appeared to be all men, though they were hidden under leather jackets and sunglasses and helmets, so he couldn't be sure. One had skin far too fair to be anything but Caucasian. The other 2 probably were also, but again, it was impossible to tell from the crappy footage. Ricky reversed it to when the kids were leaving the lodge and watched the whole thing again. As everyone was climbing into the van, Ricky paused the scene. He scrubbed the video back a few seconds and played it again, and then repeated the process. At the start of the section Ricky was reviewing, one of the chaperones, a middle-aged guy with bushy salt-and-pepper hair, had not joined the others inside the van. By all appearances, he was shutting the rear doors. That's how Ricky had interpreted it on previous viewings. But as the man went through the familiar motions this time, Ricky saw the guy glance over his shoulder in the direction the motorcycles would come from a few moments later. Not only that, the man appeared to nod in their direction, like he was acknowledging them. Or telling them he was ready. Miss Marsh had shown Ricky photos of all those who were missing. Though he hadn't been allowed to take the documents with him, she had let him use his phone to photograph each image. He shuffled through the images now and stopped on the one that matched the man in the video. "Hello, Mr. Andrew Carter," he whispered as he looked back at the computer screen. "What's your story?" A door opened in the hallway outside the office. Ricky shut the computer down and ducked below the desk.
What the hell is someone doing here already?
He checked his phone. Sure, it couldn't be much past 4 a.m., but it was almost 5. He'd spent more time looking through the computer than he'd realized. This being a hotel, 5 in the morning was not particularly early. He just hoped it wasn't the manager. Putting lousy password-protecting Scott in a quick sleeper hold would severely compromise the team's low-profile mandate. He could hear footsteps moving down the hall and then a door opening. This was followed almost immediately by the sound of voices. Ricky